This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. So if you want to know about the origins of the universe, you might want to start by talking to Laura Mersini-Houghton. She's a theoretical physicist and cosmologist at UNC Chapel Hill. Her research explores nature's big mysteries, like where the universe came from and whether worlds beyond our own exist. Laura's theories have put her on the map as one of the great minds in contemporary science. And we've asked her to join us today to talk about her work, her life, a life that began in Albania. Laura Mersini-Houghton, welcome back to the State of Things.
Good to have you here.
So you were raised in Tirana, Albania, when it was under the regime of a guy named Enver Hoxha. This was a totalitarian regime. Tell us about growing up there.
Well, it was a very interesting experience, and so different from my years in the U.S. At some level, there were a lot of difficulties, especially because of my family background. We went through a lot of exile experiences and such. But at the same time, there was this general feeling of warmth and people staying together and helping each other. And there, I was surrounded by so much love, whether it was through my family, my parents, my grandmother, or through teachers and friends. And that combination of extremes, of bad things falling upon you in a very arbitrary manner without you or your parents doing anything wrong, while at the same time the experience of basic human kindness that picked you up in the most difficult moments, that combination was a very special experience that I have not had since then.
Mm. Your father was a mathematician.
Yes, he was. He worked in applying mathematics to economics. So he worked in the field of econometrics.
And he worked for the government off and on?
Yes, he started working as a math professor at the University of Tirana. Then when I had just started school, on my first day of school, he received a letter saying that he should go on exile because he came from a family that used to be rich and title-bearing before the communism took over and therefore was considered one of the enemy of the nation at the time. He then came back from exile, worked at the Academy of Science for many years, and was sent back to exile when my brother was born 9 years later.
What was happening to you or to your relationship? Could you stay in touch with him while he was in exile?
No, because at the time, of course, internet and electronic communications did not exist. The main way of communication was via telephones, and those were also very limited. And above all, we were not allowed to show any affection towards him when he was in exile because that would be considered as a disagreement with the decision of the Communist Party to punish him. He would be allowed to come once a month for a weekend and visit the family. And those are very tender moments and very tender memories. One of the difficult moments I remember from that time was the second time he was sent in exile, when I was 9 years old and my brother was 6 months old. And I remember the time he came to visit us, he was allowed to visit us, and I insisted that I go with him to this very rural village on top of a mountain. So I finally got my wish. And as I was sitting with him waiting for the bus to come and take us back to town, I remember him asking very gently and trying to be as delicate as he possibly could, is there anything that has been bothering you during this time? He could tell from my attitude that there was something in my mind. And normally, because of all the love and the support I had and this complete conviction that only a child can have, that my father is innocent, he has done nothing wrong. So until then, I had been more upbeat and more optimistic in my attitude. But he was right that something had happened on that particular visit. And I remember I was attending school one day, and during the lunch break, I overheard some of my teachers talking to each other about me. And one of them was commenting how sorry she felt that I had to go through this as a child and that my father was away. But then another teacher, completely carelessly and maybe not very tactfully, she didn't know I was nearby and overheard the conversation, but she made a very careless comment saying, oh, he'll never come back. So I didn't say anything, but that sentence stuck in my memory. And for the first time, I was genuinely worried that I'd never see my father back. And I told my father this incident after he was pushing. And he was one of these very gentle, soft-spoken, but very wise men that not only I, but other people that talked with him always ended up agreeing with his point of view, which was larger than life. He always took a step back and said, whatever is worrying you now, it will pass. Think on the grand scheme of things. People get hired, fired, they go through a lot, but these are not really the moments you remember from life. There are more important things, and those are the ones you should focus on. So I was expecting for him to give me this speech during this conversation we were having, and he said to me, do you have one of the school books with you? And I said, yes, I do. Here is my algebra book. And he took a piece of paper, which was a poem of Pushkin, and he said, keep that in your book, and every time you are down, read that poem and think about the words in those poems, and you'll know what your father's answer is. I will come back, don't worry. And the poem was The Monument from Pushkin.
And so tell us about that. What is that the subject of that poem?
So, of course, Pushkin is talking about his work and the legacy he'll leave behind through his marvelous work. But the monument is the poem Monument is more than that. It's about the attitude in life one should have about important issues and not so important issues. And I think that's why my father wanted me to think along those lines. I can recite one or two verses.
Please do.
I have erected a monument to myself, not built by hands. The track of it, though trodden by the people, shall not become overgrown, and it stands higher than the Alexander Column. And then the last verse, be attentive, muse, to the commandments of God. Fear no insult, ask for no crown. Receive with indifference both flattery and slander, and do not argue with a fool. So that was his advice to me.
But how amazing that he could take this moment. He didn't know that you had Pushkin's The Monument with you, and he was able to turn to this, find it, and then make that the teaching moment.
Pushkin was one of his favorite poets, yeah. and he was very fond of literature and poetry and art. And this particular poem he knew by heart. Another one that he often reminded me of was from Lermontov, Smile in your difficult days, other more beautiful days will come soon. So...
And how did he explain to you what was happening? Again, this had to be a difficult negotiation, a kind of a dance to keep you out of trouble, to keep you from becoming enraged, and yet try to explain what's happening politically.
He tried the best he could by telling me the truth, that this is the family I come from. We have never done anything against the nation, so we are not really enemies. On the other hand, of course, everyone, including the current government, would be concerned that we might harbor bitterness feelings because they took away, confiscated all the property and the estates and the land and the wealth that we have. However, because my father was a very young child when that happened, and he was completely absorbed into his world of science and mathematics and beauty. And that was by choice. He made a choice to live by beauty rather than bitterness. That's why, in reality, there were no bitter feelings. People just did not regret or think back on what might have been if the regime had not taken over. And it was exactly this kind of positive feelings that he tried to reinforce on me. And the most important message that came, that kept coming up over and over again in our discussions was, it is up to you to choose whether you live a happy and beautiful life or not. There will always be troubles. It doesn't matter whether it's this regime or some other place and some other rules of another society. The world will always be divided in talented people that try to make changes and therefore face opposition, and mediocre people that will always try to make trouble, no matter what the excuse, whether it's the wealth or something else, but the mediocre people that will try to make trouble and make it difficult for talented people. And of course, as a free human being, you have a choice focusing a lot on the negative aspect, on the resistance people are placing in front of you, or in ignoring everything around you and just concentrating on what beautiful things you can build out of your imagination and with your hands.
Did you find beauty in science early in your school life?
Yes, very much so. In terms of education, the education at that time was very at very high standards, and There was this genuine passion towards higher learning, and I think that goes back to a tradition of Albanian people for many centuries. There is a deep respect for knowledge and for education. At the same time, there was a necessity to emphasize that part because of the regime. In communism, people are supposed to be equal, although it doesn't work that way. The way it works is that freethinkers and intellectuals are persecuted relative to the rest because they are the dangerous part of the society that can question the system.
I want to take a break right here, and we're going to come back and talk more with my guest, Laura Mersini Houghton, a cosmologist, theoretical physicist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll talk more about her career and a little bit about what she tells us about the world we live in. We'll talk about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For most of us, the Big Bang Theory is an answer, but for my guest this hour, it's an answer that raises a lot of questions. Laura Mersini Houghton's work delves deeper into the origins of the universe, particle matter, and whether there are worlds beyond our own. Laura is an associate professor of cosmology and theoretical physics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and with me in the studio today, you're talking about how it was that you came to embrace science really at a very early age.
I never had any influence or pressure in the practical sense. Neither one of my parents or anyone else tried to push me into the scientific direction. Part of it could have been, I'd like to think that they were smart enough to understand my psychology and not push me in a direction I might not have wanted to pursue. But ending up in science happened in such a natural manner that I don't even think that I made the choice in becoming a scientist. When in the early years of education, I discovered that I enjoyed mathematics and physics and biology and chemistry much more than some of the social sciences. I always loved arts and literature, and I still continue to enjoy those. But when it came to subjects like history, for example, or geography, I was hopeless, and that's why it became clear quite soon that I would end up pursuing one of the natural sciences direction. Then in high school, my school participated in the National Olympiads, and they asked me to represent them in mathematics and physics. And the first time I got the second prize in the nation, and the second time I got the first prize in the nation, and that was just 1 year before applying to university to go to the higher education. So it became clear that the field was narrowed down even more into two subjects, that I'd either study math or physics. Because the prize I won was in physics, I ended up signing up for the physics department. However, I was never quite sure whether that choice ended up being made in the spur of the moment, simply as the result of the Olympiad, or whether that was something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So in the second year of my studies at the university, I decided to sign up for the math department as well.
And this was in Tirana, the University of Tirana,
yes,
the capital of Albania. So were there any impediments? Because, you know, one of the things we find in this country is that women at least had been, maybe things are changing a little bit now, but had been discouraged or not as encouraged as men to enter the sciences, certainly at a time you would have been coming in. What about in Albania?
In those days, that was one of the surprising findings I had when I moved from Albania to the States. In those days in Albania, at least in my experience, people never thought of a girl's profession and a boy's profession. There was no stereotyping, and that kind of distinction did not start at an early age, and it never carried on later on. There were as many female students at the University of Tirana as male students, and the same with the faculty body. There were as many female professors as there were male professors. In my family, certainly, there was no such prejudice that a girl should follow a certain profession, that a boy should follow another profession. It could have been because I was an only child for 9 years. I came from a family that was well-educated and with a long intellectual tradition. That might have been the reason. However, when I look at my peers and my friends, their families that came from all different backgrounds, they did not have to go through any such prejudice either. I came across that problem for the first time, actually, when I won a Fulbright scholarship and went to study at the University of Maryland in College Park. The University of Maryland is one of these fantastic schools, very large graduate school. There were about 200 graduate students. That is January 94 when I moved there. There were only 3 female graduate students. The rest of the 200 students were men. That's probably one of the funny experiences I remember from the early days in the U.S. The majority of the male graduate students had signed up for ballet classes. It was the only way to meet girls because there were no girls in the graduate school. And I would have never thought before then that physics and ballet go together so well.
It's actually hard to hold some of those poses. It's very difficult to explain apart from particle physics. Did you experience it then firsthand? And obviously, the numbers told you something about the culture here, but then did you experience any of that kind of discrimination as a woman in this country?
I did, yes. At first, I was not prepared for it. That was a surprise for me. I gradually learned how not only to recognize the signs, but also how to ignore that kind of negative aspect. But of course, My life and my career here involves some struggles related to being a woman in physics, especially in theoretical physics. And the two main problems I can see are, first, the sheer lack of numbers of female students in physics makes them a very rare species that the majority of people are not used to how to handle. And that is sad. I can see that factor now from the other side of the fence. Now that I teach, I can see that I start with a large number of female students at the undergraduate level, and somehow that number decreases at graduate studies, and then it becomes really small at the faculty level. The other problem that one discovers later on in the career is the glass ceiling. That's a harder one to identify. It's transparent. You don't see it, but you can feel it. That certainly is one of the reasons why the number of female theoretical physicists is so limited. I didn't check the recent statistics. It used to be about 3% of the population in theoretical physics is female, which is a scary statistic. That number has not changed since Marie Curie. And we definitely have to do something about that because I strongly believe there is absolutely no difference between a female scientist and a male scientist. There is no such thing as a difference between them. I only believe in good scientists and not so good scientists, whether they are men or women. Therefore, by not having the participation of half of the population of this country in this field, we are really missing on half of the growth and half of the discoveries that could have been made by those numbers.
Well, the only real difference is, I guess, the men, male scientists, have developed a deeper appreciation of ballet owing to their extracurricular activities. Apart from that, their science is probably the same. So what's happening? How is that possible? Certainly our consciousness has been raised. We've talked about it. Efforts, you know, the university and the academy talks all about this. And yet you're still seeing this drop off from undergrad
Yes, okay. So I mean, part of the problem is that natural sciences, almost by definition, are not as easy to follow as other fields in a society. For example, there are checks and balances, and there you can identify all the steps in a problem in business, in a business environment, and identify where does that chain break and where do you lose female participation. It is not so easy in natural sciences, and that's part of the reason why it's been difficult to change those statistics. But I think another problem might also be related to the image of a scientist. I come across various people that I meet in cocktail parties or when I get invited from my husband's part of France, and they are often surprised that I am a professor of theoretical physics, because many of them have this image that professors should have this nerdy look of thick glasses, a t-shirt and jeans, and many young girls would not want to look like that. They don't want to lose their identity and their femininity for the sake of having a career in science. And that image, that's part of the work we have to do, because the two are not exclusive. That image of a woman trying to look like a man or to look like a nerdy professor does not necessarily mean that you would make you a great scientist.
Does that come from the way we teach physics, the fact that perhaps we have in our teaching of science, and I don't mean that it's inherent in science, but the way we teach it, it has become abstract from, alien from the humanities. You talked about your father's love of poetry. It's clearly that poetry that helps you transcend what you're facing today and that kind of depth, philosophical look at what you're doing. We don't teach it that way. Is it possible that it begins to filter for those who see science only as the numbers and not in this deeper, more beautiful way you describe?
That's certainly part of the problem, and I believe that's a component that my whole community should work and devote more time on in trying to change the image of the scientist, because in reality, all good science is art, because at the end of the day, all that matters is creativity, whether it's in natural sciences or arts and literature or music. So by that token, the image of an artist, a poet or a scientist would be the same, since it's influenced by their way of thinking. Yet, especially when it comes to women, we do have this stereotype. Of course, we have it for men as well. We expect men to have a beard, glasses and look professorial, and many of the kids do not aspire to that. They rather look like a rock and roller than professorial. However, that image needs to be changed. What we need to emphasize is the arts, the creativity, the beauty of that discovery process, the eureka moment that makes life worth living.
And it does spring from the imagination. So here I want to get you to talk about your science and some of the theories. So let's delve into this. You have opened the path to help us understand that our universe may be one of many universes, the multiverse. Tell us a little bit about that. What is it that you're saying here? Because if I think of universe, I'd say, well, if there are more than one, then that's the universe. It's all one. But you have a very specific idea about the way this has an impact on the stuff of our universe, the way we perceive time and all of it.
I started working on the question of the origins of the universe when I first moved to the University of North Carolina in 2004. And at the time, I was asking the same question that probably humans were asking 10,000 years ago, looking, admiring the beauty of the sky and thinking, where did this all come from and why? Why did it have to start this way? At that same time, I got lucky because the whole community of string theorists who had been working for 20 years discovered something known as the landscape of string theory. Now, the way they discovered this landscape structure is that in string theory, you start with space-time being 11-dimensional, but then you want to make all these extra dimensions really small and invisible in order to end up with only three space dimensions, height, length, and width, and one time direction. So once you do this process of wrapping the extra dimensions, of almost getting rid of the extra dimensions, making them invisible, what you end up doing is dumping a lot of energy in what's left in this three space plus one time direction. And there had been a lot of work devoted by mathematicians and string theorists. The goal this community had in mind was that eventually they would end up with just one universe that has three space plus one time direction and that looked like ours. That would solve the origins problem. What they ended up with instead was an almost infinite number of worlds that had three space plus one time dimension and looked like our universe. So that was also around 2003-2004. And the string community considered that the worst crisis in the history of string theory, because if you predict so many possible universes, it seems that string theory should lose its predictive powers. It cannot be falsified anymore. For any observation we can make, you can find a match in that landscape of string theory. At the time that this crisis was going on in the string community and I was thinking about the origins of the universe, I took a radical point of view that was very different from the community. And I considered this discovery of many possible worlds from string theory that was dubbed the landscape, I considered that to be a great finding that actually did make string theory a good candidate for the theory of everything and the theory of the origins. The reason I thought that was because I could not imagine how can I ask a question, why did I start with this universe, if all I have to start with is this universe? I need a pool of many possible universes in order to ask that question in a meaningful way. And then the end result of that exercise is really a Copernican extension to the whole universe. Because what we are really advocating and saying and proving is that there is nothing special about our universe, because it's not the only thing ever created. There are so many other universes just like ours around. We are one humble member in a large family of universes that's been named the multiverse.
But if I understand what the worry of the string theorist was, that if they had all of these universes, it would render almost science itself meaningless, because if my answer could be infinite and infinity, then really I might as well chuck science and become a philosopher. Aren't we still there? Does this in any way render the kind of theories that we have, the equations that explain certain interactions and reactions and relationships, does this mean now that they are all relative and can be rewritten any which way to accommodate any of those infinite universes?
Excellent, excellent question. Philosophers won't be very happy with you, Frank. But absolutely. So that saying that we need a multiverse structure, we need many possible universes to start with, that's only the beginning of the story. Then that's where science should kick in. Then we need to figure out a selection criteria that is based on physics equations, on scientific equations, and that's the proposal I put forth in 2004. I thought, if we think of the universe before space-time is actually born, in the very, very early moments, before the Big Bang, if we think of that universe in quantum mechanics terms, in other words, I can think of the universe as a wave packet, then I can allow this wave packet to go through the landscape discovered by string theorists. I have a whole set of equations of formalism given by quantum mechanics. I can solve a Schrödinger equation that will tell me what will happen to this wave packet, whether a universe is actually born out of it, and what does it look like. So that's where the physics kicks in and where the selection criteria comes out of the dynamics of the system.
And I can't pretend to have understood every bit of that, but I'll ask this. Is this wave packet, this beginning, this moment before our physics was born, right? The instant before the Big Bang. Is there just one of those that then spawns many universes, or are there an infinite number of those moments that happen all throughout existence and then bang into each other on their way to?
There is an infinite number, if you like, a whole family of these wave packets. Mm. There is no reason to start with just one. Again, mathematically and scientifically, you'll have a family of these wave packets or wave functions that you let to propagate through this landscape of string theory. But then you ask the question, if I let them go in this structure of energy valleys and energy mountains, what will happen to them? Do they evolve? Do they actually give birth to universes? And that part can be studied through equations. We don't have to guess the answer, and we don't need any input, whether it's philosophical or a conjecture or anything.
And the good news is you don't overturn the physics of my universe, so that is still intact, and it is still not variable, right? It is still not relative. And all it means is that there may be whole other bodies of physics, whole other rules of physics in these other universes.
Absolutely. It says that there are many other universes like ours, but it also explains to us the origins question, which is, why did we have to start at high energies? Why did we bang at high energies? What banged at high energies? And that's what it banged. It was a wave packet on the landscape of string theory, which is derived from a physical theory. And that wave packet had matter and energy in it. Right. Now, what energy does is try to explode that initial patch and blow it up in bigger in size. What matter does, we all know what it does. It likes to crunch things into a black hole. You have both in each single wave packet. So the fight, the opposing tendencies of these two components will determine whether that initial wave packet will grow big and give birth to a universe or not. Some of those wave packets did give birth to universes like ours at high energies. The ones that started at low energies were stillbirths. They never produced the universe.
My guest this hour, theoretical physicist and cosmologist Laura Mersini-Houghton. More on the state of things as our program continues. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, Laura Mersini-Houghton, Associate Professor of Cosmology, Theoretical Physics, Particle Astrophysics, String Cosmology, and High Energy Physics at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. That's the only time we gave you all of your credentials, because we're never going through that again. That's a lot. And it's an awful lot, and you bring it all together in a way that I think, you know, at some level is understandable for me. Obviously, at the edges and the experience and education you have, beyond me. But the idea that there may not have been one big bang, there might have been many, and all of those bangs might have created new universes that would have different laws is something I think I can understand if I grasped it. And the interesting thing is that this theory that you've developed actually has tests.
Yes, when I was working on this theory from 2004 onwards until about 2006, of course, I had to keep reminding myself of the most basic working principle, which is humility. We are asking questions about the origins of the universe, and as enjoyable as that is, and as excited as I would get from that eureka moment when I first had the idea on how to scientifically solve the problem, I would never contemplate for a minute that nature would care less about what I was saying. And that was part of the reason why in 2006, together with two collaborators, Takahashi in Japan and Holman in Carnegie Mellon in the US, we sat down to calculate what predictions we can make out of this theory that can be tested by observations in the present day. And we predicted a series of signatures that should be imprinted in the sky. Those signatures come from the crosstalk of our universe with all these other universes. Now, remember, the theory explains how these universes are born and the reason why you end up with more than one birth, more than one Big Bang. But, of course, we have a whole set of equations that tell us how these universes evolve from the Big Bang time to present day. And we also can calculate what the how they are talking to each other, in the sense that there is a interaction, a gravitational interaction of all these universes, no matter how far away they are, but they are all pulling gravitationally onto each other. The strength of that interaction is tiny, of course. However, it is sufficient to leave a signature on our sky today. And that's how we were able to get a handle on the prediction. So we predicted in 2005, 2006 that there should be a large area of the sky, about 10 degrees on the sky, and far away, about 9 billion light years away, that should be completely void of matter, of galaxies, stars, and everything. It should be empty. We got lucky there. 8 months later, WMAP experiment and Minnesota astronomers, Rudnick et al., actually saw what they called the cold spot.
Why would it be empty? It's because the gravitational pull has pushed this stuff out. It's
exactly
created this void. But, I mean, we know a little bit about, if I understand the physics, Big Bang means things are highly organized and compressed. They become more entropic, in other words, more chaotic, and disorganized over time. So this could have been just a happy accident. There's this one just blank space in space, because entropy does that. It makes stuff someplace and not stuff in other places.
No, absolutely. And that could have been a good argument against the influence of other universes. If this cold spot, if this region of the sky was tiny. You do expect, after all, that's why we are so fond of the standard Big Bang cosmology, because we do expect a uniform distribution of empty space as well as over dense space, as space with galaxies and stars. In other words, you may expect 1 degree in the sky to be empty, but not 10 degrees. 10 degrees is 1/6 of the observable sky. That's no accident. Something scooped out the matter from that region. And it was so ridiculous as a prediction, so frightening, that actually a theory would dare and come up in the public and say, oh, well, I say 1/6 of your sky should be empty, should not be uniform. That at the time we were writing the paper, one of my collaborators asked if we can cut out and not mention that prediction, which luckily we didn't. But another prediction, which gets even spookier, was the dark flow of galaxies. And that flow of galaxies was observed by a NASA-led team of Kashlinsky, and it involves the X-ray telescope in Hawaii as well. Basically, what's happening is, if you think of the universe as a balloon, as the balloon grows, all the air molecules inside should move with the same speed as the walls of the balloon. So everything, to an inbound person, observer that's inside the balloon, everything should look pretty much looking at the same velocity. That's the story of galaxies. That's what we expect, at least, for galaxies and all the stuff in the universe. We expect it to move at the same speed and rate as the expansion of the universe. In other words, these galaxies, this structure, should be at rest relative to the universe. What we predicted was that if you take into account this extra force coming from outside, from talking with the other universes, then you should have a sliding of all the structure in the universe relative to the expansion frame of the universe, relative to the walls of the universe. We called that the bulk flow, and it was observed by NASA 2 years later in 2008, and they named it the dark flow because it's quite mysterious.
Now, does that mean that galaxies, instead of being uniformly distributed, in fact have are privileging one side over the other?
Absolutely.
There's too many going in one direction.
They are all sliding along one preferred direction, which is relative to the expansion frame of the universe. In other words, it's like air molecules would have a mind of their own and move relative to the walls of the balloon.
So you think that even though there is an infinite number of other universes, that in fact they're all related. They all have an impact on each other.
Absolutely. So it's not so much that I think that, but we know that because it's one of the sacred principles of quantum mechanics. It's called the unitarity principle, which basically says information about this system can never be lost. If this universes were talking at birth, because they were all wave packets living on that same landscape and following the same evolution laws, then that information about their crosstalk is present today. That information can never be lost. We just have to be clever enough and figure out how to track it down.
And it's not only theory, but as you say, it's testable and has been tested. Yeah. So now you've taken us to the very edge of the universe, and I'm going to ask you to take one step back even beyond that and ask in a kind of a deep philosophical way whether or not all of this is simply bound by, in other words, all of these understandings that we have of the universe are bound by our own limits of perception, that this is the way we tell ourselves the story about the universe, but it's only in our head. It's a construction that works for humans bound to the earth, evolved the way they did.
I like this question because I used to think a lot about this and spend a lot of time when I was contemplating the theory of the origins of the universe. And I had to remind myself, is this only my perception or does that have any bearing to physical reality, whatever that is? I wouldn't even know what that is. But I have come to acknowledge that both elements are there. In one hand, there is this strong element of the human need to understand the origins of the universe and the world around us. That is essential to human existence. And that is the reason why I'm not the first one to ask the question about the origins. I'm sure that humans 10,000 or even a million years before me have been asking the same question. So there is that need that is essential to making us humans, to differentiating us from animals. But I also do believe that because science is not faith-based, but is evidence-based, that there is an element of truth. And at least in science that survives and ends up with a legacy. And that element of truth is always determined by experiments, by astronomy, by observations, by accelerators. As long as the theory passes all the experimental tests, then I am willing to accept that that is not only my perception, it does not only exist in my imagination, but actually it might have some bearing to what's really happening in nature.
So as someone who thinks about perception itself and then about the big questions about the subject of our and the objects of our perception, how has your career, your scientific inquiry, if it has at all, changed or expanded your understanding of yourself?
It has, of course, quite a lot because our work does influence our lives and our way of thinking. In my case, and probably that's the case with many scientists, but at least I can speak for myself. In my case, my approach has always been to go after the beauty and the excitement of discovering a part of truth about nature that I'd very much like to know and understand. And that's been the driving motivation and the reward at the end of the road. However, once you go through the exercise of a big fundamental question about nature, then whether you like it or not, you cannot be part of your own world anymore. You have to take that theory out to the world. You have to have it scrutinized by your colleagues and community. You also have to survive all the other parts of human nature that go with the territory. So at the end of that road, which is not what I bargained for, I only wanted the scientific beauty, but I got more than that. At the end of that road, I realized that what Schopenhauer said about truth is actually correct. And he said truth goes through three stages. In the first stage, it is ridiculed. In the second stage, it is violently opposed. And in the third stage, well, of course, it becomes self-evident. Everybody knows about it. And I've gone through these stages, and the first two stages, of course, are not fun, but they are completely worth it if you end up seeing that a field you start by throwing an idea suddenly becomes a mainstream field.
How often have you gone back to that poem by Pushkin?
Quite often. I was actually talking about that poem when my father died a year ago, to his brothers and family, and we were reminiscing about his life and how important that poem was.
You, art is important to you. Do you find yourself going to art, moving to art and poetry in those moments of crisis when your work is at the point of ridicule and worse, you know, fierce opposition?
Another excellent question. I think the beauty of art and poetry and literature and music above all, for in my case, I put music above all else. Those are essential to survival. Of course, there is a burnout factor if you struggle long enough and cannot find the answer that you are after. My immediate trick against frustration, if I'm stuck with a set of equations or if I have 10 opposing scenarios in my head and I made them all up, so I cannot favor one against the other, but still I have to find something wrong with all those ideas and if I'm lucky, reduce 10 ideas into one. Then in that case, the way I get around that frustration and that kind of opposite thinking is by going for a long walk. And the faster I walk, then the faster I think. But when it comes to setting the creativity mood on actually trying to come up with that idea of looking at the problem from all possible angles and figuring out what might have people done wrong that they did not get to the answer. In those moments, music and art are crucial. I always like to sit in a room where I'm surrounded by art and I have classical music on the background. That's the most inspiring way to think deeply and also to detach from the daily life.
You say your father passed away last year, so he has seen you or had seen you grow in your career. How did he feel about where you had come in your career?
He was, of course, extremely happy and biased as well, of course. He was my dad. We were extremely close. We were the best friends as well, and that's the part I miss the most about him. But as my best friend, he was more concerned about the advice he had to give me. He had been there, done that, gone through all the bad and the good experiences and the excitement at the end of the road. So he felt that he always had to warn me not to get ahead of myself and to be reminded that I should be humble and just enjoy the pleasure of the process. The fun is in discovering, in not what not the fame or the awards that come afterwards. But so he never actually tried to brag about me in front of me. I'm sure he had done that abundantly behind my back. But when he died, I asked my family, can I be the first one to open the door of the house? I was hoping, because it was a very sudden death, so I just hoped that maybe I can catch a glimpse of a shirt hanging on the door or a cigarette on the ashtray, something that would give me part of him. And I didn't. The house was spotless. Everything was in order. And then I went to look at his studio. And then when I knew how proud he was of me, he had saved all the newspapers and magazines and TV programs, whatever has ever been published about this work. He had created a huge shelf on his studio and saved them all.
Did you bring it back with you, or is it still there?
No. He had mentioned sometimes to me that when people write about you, you should save those. These are good memories to have. And, of course, I'm very disorganized, so I never kept those magazines. But apparently he had done that for me and never mentioned it.
Well, because he knew that about you. So now I've got a minute left, and I'm going to ask you what you're working on. But this is kind of crazy to ask a cosmologist and give her a minute to give us a sense of what you're working on.
What I'm working on now is trying to figure out how the two major theories of the multiverse can either converge into one theory or whether one of them is not capturing physical reality as well as the other, therefore it has to go. So I'm trying to unify those two pictures.
We'll have you back when you do that.
Thank you.
Laura, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Laura Mersini-Houghton, Associate Professor of Cosmology, Particle Astrophysics, String Cosmology, and High Energy Physics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org. You can find a link to some of the calendar of events that we've mentioned and also listen to archived editions of the program. State of Things produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Haley Sklut is our intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.